Hi, everyone, and welcome to Las Musas Podcast. My name is Mia Garcia, and I'm the author of The Resolutions. Today, I'm joined by Michelle Ruiz Kyle, and today on this episode of Radio Musas, we'll be talking about Michelle's upcoming book, Summer in the City of Roses. Michelle, can you start us off by introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about your book?
Sure. Hi, Mia. I am a writer and tarot reader, and I am also a kind of a non-professional scholar of fairy tales. I've been fascinated and obsessed with them my whole life, with, you know, fairy tale and myth. And Summer in the City of Roses actually comes out of this obsession I had with two stories that seemed to have nothing to do with each other for a really long time. One is the Grimm fairy tale, Little Brother and Little Sister. And the other is Greek myths about siblings Iphigenia and Orestes. And I had both of these sort of rolling around in my head for a long time. And suddenly I started to realize, actually, what's really fascinating about these stories is the way that family trouble and trauma affects the siblings, and how that sort of plays out, and how their stories sort of come together and diverge and come back together in both this, you know, Grimm fairy tale, which has this European origin, and this ancient Greek myth. So as I started to see the similarities, a story began to sort of rise up, and it ended up being set in early 90s Portland. And it combines Riot Girl history, lots of things that made 90s Portland a fascinating place to live. That's when I moved to Portland. So I was really interested in that time period in the city, and also what magic this place has. Place is always important to me. So all of those combined into this, into the story of siblings Iphigenia and Orestes, who are 17 and 15 and who have been very close with an dancer mother who has been a stay-at-home mom and taking care of them their whole lives. And their family is very sort of close-knit with not a lot of outside interaction in the world. They've kind of made their own little world that in some ways has not really included their father as they've gotten older. Then their mom goes away to an artist residency for a month. Dad is left in charge and the world explodes. And the siblings find themselves after a series of difficult events, both on their own in the middle of Portland for the first time in their lives. And they have to find each other and figure out how they're going to heal this huge rift that has happened in their family. So that's basically it.
And that was awesome. That was a wonderful explanation. And we're going to dive a little bit deeper after our reading to all of the elements that you mentioned just now. So we are going to go into an excerpt from The Summer in the City of Roses, published by Soho Press, coming July 6. Act 1. Whoever drinks from me will become a tiger. The first acquaintance with a part. It's the middle of summer, but of course, there's rain. Clouds race past, covering and uncovering the moon. Ip's heels squish with water, insult to the blistering injuries that are her feet. Her mother's cashmere sweater, already two sizes too small, is now a second skin. She stops at a wide, busy street that might be familiar if she'd remembered her glasses, but those along with her purse are far away, sitting innocent and hopeful on the white tablecloth in the hotel banquet room. A guy across the street beams a glance her way and walks backwards a few steps so he can keep looking. She concedes a point to Dad. Earlier tonight, when she swanned into the living room in her white movie star dress, he nodded approval at the first impression. Glamorous, but appropriate. Followed by a jaw drop of horror when his eyes reached her chest. If turned without a word and got the sweater out of her mother's closet. Oversized and beachy on Gammon Mom, not quite button-upable on If. Although Mom has trained Dad against sexism of policing his daughter's clothes, Dad insists on a basic truth. Men are malakes, disgusting. A wolf whistle follows her around the corner, bringing the point home. If turns away from the busy street, Burnside, she thinks, squinting at the blurry sign, and walks back the way she came. A car drives by a little too slow. More men, more eyes. This never happens in Forest Lake. She isn't scared, but maybe she should be. The trick to bad neighborhoods, Dad once told her, is to act like you belong. She was 12 or 13 then, brought along to pick up a load of salvaged building materials from a part of the city people called Felony Flats. Staring out the rain-spattered window of his truck at the small houses with their peeling front porches and dandelion gardens, if wondered what exactly made a neighborhood bad. An older woman wearing a blanket instead of a raincoat shuffles past on the other side of the street. A car whizzes by, blasting the Beatles. Yellow Submarine to go with the weather, a childhood road trip favorite. If would give anything to be in that silver Volvo now, sharing a pillow with Orr in the back. She stops. She can't think about her brother. Can't stand here crying in the rain with no coat. She takes a deep breath and starts walking again. Each step cuts like her gold heels are the cursed shoes of a punished girl in a fairy tale. She passes an alleyway. The same creepy car that slowed down before is turning in. A group of kids, some who look younger than her, are leaning against the wall, smoking. If hurries by, the scent of wet asphalt and urine wafts toward her on the wind. If wills her nose to stop working. So, yeah, this neighborhood is probably what her father would call bad. She should go back and face him. Find some way to make him change his mind. But there's no making Dad do anything. Not when he thinks he's right. It's humiliating how useless she is out in the real world. Like a jewelry box ballerina waiting to be sprung. She's dreamed her life away in her pink suburban bedroom, sleeping as much as possible, re-watching her favorite movies, and rereading her favorite books. She always thought she'd be one of those kids who got their driver's license the day of their 16th birthday, so she could drive into Portland whenever she wanted. Like Mom, she loved the city, but 16 came and went without even a learner's permit. Once, years ago, If heard Mom talking on the phone to her best friend. If I had known how white it was in Oregon, she said, I would have made Theo transfer to NYU and raise the kids in Brooklyn. City girl Mom made the best of it. Portland was still mostly white, but more liberal and diverse than Forest Lake. She'd take If and Orr into Portland weekly since they were little, for Orr's cello lessons and If's theater camps, trips to the museum and plays and record stores and summertime Shakespeare in the Park. Most often they go to Powell's, the enormous bookstore downtown that covers an entire city block. The streets around If look a little like those, but really all the streets in downtown Portland look like this. Art Deco apartment buildings crowded next to sooty turn-of-the-century low-rises Dad calls brickies. Parking lots next to Gothic churches, nondescript mid-century offices, and newish high-rises shiny with rain-washed glass. In Portland, or everywhere really, If has been content to let Mom do the driving, the thinking, the deciding. They all have. And now, after 2 weeks without her, their family is broken, and If can't imagine a fix. She stops at an intersection and squints at the sign. The streetlight is out, so it's only a blur. Something hot is oozing from her heel. Her fingertips come back bloody. Blood has always made If feel faint. Sometimes she actually does faint. She looks for somewhere to wipe her hand. On the corner is a box with the free weekly paper. She rips the cover page in half and does her best with the blood. Doesn't see a trash can and settles for folding the sullied paper and sending it down the storm drain. A lesser form of littering, she hopes. She breathes through the pain in her feet. She needs a break, a plan. She leans against the nearest wall. The stucco snags Mom's sweater. What a waste. And for nothing, the whole outfit, the whole evening was a con. If cringes at her 3 hours ago self, proudly walking into that hotel on Dad's arm. When the band began Fly Me to the Moon, he even asked her to dance. They waltzed easily, him singing the words so only she could hear them. When she was little, they'd bonded over Old Blue Eyes, which is what Dad calls Frank Sinatra. He twirled her and dropped her into a dip. a routine from their father-daughter dance in middle school. His co-workers smiled and Iff remembered what it was like when she and Dad were close. "Sweetie," he said as the song ended, "I need to talk to you about something."
Sensing the hunter's footstep, Orr sees stars, thinks about the phrase, "he saw stars," words for a cartoon head injury, a cast iron pan to the head. He gags, a sudden rancidness, the scent of an unwashed pan, the way the kitchen smells when Dad's away and Mom leaves the dishes in the sink all week. But this isn't kitchen grease or a dream. It's the smell of the men pulling him from his bed. A sack covers his head. His arms ache where hands grip him, lift him. The upstairs hall tilts by in the shadow world outside the thin black fabric. Or remembers to scream. He flails, knocking into a chair, the countertop. He reaches out to the bumpy plaster wall of the entryway and claws at the worn spot next to the phone. But the men yank him away. The alarm beeps its familiar goodbye as the front door slams shut. Orr quiets, listens. The night is cool and smells like rain. He is strapped into a vehicle. Like Agent Scully on the X-Files, he is being abducted. His sockless feet are clammy in his shoes, tied too tight by his kidnappers. His breathing is shallow. A meltdown builds. He reaches inside for the ghost in him, the thing Mom calls to Alma, his soul. But the ghost is gone, hiding or fled. With his index finger, he traces the map line of the West Coast on his leg, from British Columbia to Baja California. Questions form. Where am I? Where are they taking me? And why? He breathes a little deeper, wiggles his toes, tells them it's okay, waits for the world to settle. He is in a large car, possibly a van. The cracked vinyl seat is a fanged menace under the worn flannel of his too short pajama pants. Summer rain hisses under the tires. The radio switches on, a sports station blaring. Orr reaches for music, his battered Klangel, Volume 1, with its old world yellow cover and pages of punishing drills he's grown to love. He recalls every detail of the slick round stickers his teacher placed on the fingerboard when he was a beginner. He remembers the deep cramping of new muscle in his wrist and hand. His right elbow crooks around an invisible bow. His legs shake the cello's curves until he can almost feel its purr. The radio drones on and on. Baseball. Orr knows more than he cares to about the game. For Dad's sake, he's tried to love it. The announcer's voice is deep and comforting. The rhythm of thwack, cheer, talk surprisingly helps Orr think. Details coalesce. The silent house, the men, the way he never heard them enter. The alarm's familiar sequence of beats because they knew the code. They knew. Orr narrows his eyes in the solitude of the hood. Fucking Dad. That's what If would say. This whole ordeal is because of Dad and that awful brochure. The van stops. Orr is unsure how much time has passed. "Okay, kid," a voice says, and the sack is pulled from Orr's head. The waxing moon is bright as a bare light bulb in the star-exploded sky. Crickets chirp. Frogs harmonize in the deep forest hush. The gravel parking lot is a stark landing pad in a tree-circled compound. Orr nods. This has been a long time coming. Finally, here he is, a prisoner at the fascist re-education facility for inadequate specimens, also known as the Meadowbrook Rehabilitation Center for Boys Boot Camp. He's heard of it, of course, a place for kids who did drugs or kids who got into fights. Kids with something they need to change. What is Orr supposed to change? He doesn't get into fights, has no interest in drugs. He's quiet, but silence is part of him, heads to the tails of his music. The driver closes the van. Another man guides Orr toward a building that looks like some sort of lodge. A third walks ahead. This one is taller than the others, with a back like a bull's. 1 second, Orr is fine. Then he's not. He sees now that his calm in the van was only his mind's clever ruse to protect himself and fool the men. Sound boils in the tar pit of his stomach, but Orr won't let it out. It's an experiment, an untested suggestion from his therapist. Contain the meltdown without dissociating. Talk to it. Make it your friend. The lodge looms closer. The mountain silently watches. Orm morphs the meltdown into a tactical step. Sound transmutes to animal knowing. He feigns a slip, a twisted ankle. The man releases his arm and bends down. After that, Orr doesn't think. He just runs.
It was wonderful. Thank you. Well,
thank
let's
you,
go.
Anna.
Oh, this was great. Let's go into some questions and really pull apart the novel and start with the names, right? So we got Orr and If. What do these names mean? And do they signify something in your character's journey? You alluded to this a little bit earlier, but often by giving our characters certain names, we set them on a particular path. So what is Orr and If, and how does that set them on their path in this novel?
Yes, well, Iphigenia and Orestes are part of the sort of cursed clan of Atreides in Greek mythology. So Agamemnon is their father. And the way I first came into their stories was actually through some of the Greek tragedies about Iphigenia. There's one called Iphigenia at Aeolus and Iphigenia among the Taurians. And I was always curious because, you know, Iphigenia was sacrificed to the goddess Athena because the winds weren't blowing and the armies of Troy were just sort of stuck. The armies of Greece were stuck and were not able to go and fight Troy when the Trojan War, you know, at the very beginning of the Trojan War. So Iphigenia was lured to where the ships were docked with the promise of marrying Achilles. And so she thinks she's coming for her wedding and her mother thinks that too. And then what she finds out when she gets there is that's not the case at all. And then in some versions of the story, luckily at the last moment when she's about to be sacrificed on this altar, she is quick saved by the goddess Artemis and a deer is placed in her place. So deer imagery is really important all through the story and I won't give anything away, but that's a big part of it. So that detail was actually what sort of connected me back to the fairy tale. And then as for Orestes, her brother Orestes, basically, you know, it's Greek tragedy. So, you know, Clytemnestra never forgives her husband for what he almost did or did to Iphigenia, depending on which story that you read. And so she gets her revenge and then Orestes gets his revenge on his mother. And then of course, because matricide is a horrible thing to do, the Furies, which are this group of like, you know, terrifying, vengeful female goddesses chase Orestes and never let him rest. And so there's also something in there about Orestes sort of feeling hunted, feeling, and also maybe some metaphors about mental health and about neurodifference that I started to see in Orestes' story. So I gave them these names and I thought, why would parents give their kids these names? These are tragic, terrible stories. But then I also thought about the way that Greek families are named, and often they're named after other family members. And so I thought, well, we can have a brother named Orestes and we can have a beloved grandmother named Iphigenia and they can decide that they want to name the kids for them. And I also sort of, that also really led me deeper into the story because then I thought, why not name anyone from the mom's family? But then I thought sometimes when we have trauma in our family, you know, we really want to stay away from anything that reminds us. And that is the case for If and Orr's mom. So it really led me kind of deeply into the story about generational trauma, about how even when we try to protect our kids in every possible way, which these parents really have done with their children, sometimes our stories as parents and our unresolved pain and our unresolved issues, you know, leak into our kids' lives. And they're the ones who do something to make a change that kind of heals everyone. So I've seen this happen in families and I've seen it happen in my own family, both with my generation and then now with my daughter's generation, because they've grown up and they've taught us so much about ourselves. So this was sort of all the things that were whirling around and working together to set the kids on their journey. But you're right, their names, once I figured out that I was really going to use these names, not just the sort of idea of the deer imagery, then the whole story did open up.
Well, then speaking of how the story came together and how it poured out of you, how were it or and if in the story created? Were they born from the fairy tale and the Greek myth? Like, did it? I always feel like writing a book is like a little bit like a tapestry, like you're putting the strings together and they come together eventually to form this beautiful painting. So given that you had all these wonderful sources and all this wonderful material to pull from, how did Or and If come about in the end?
Well, it's kind of funny because, like I said, these stories were like kind of swirling around in my head. And to be honest, I was applying for a residency and they said, describe the project you'll be working on at this residency. And I'm like, I don't know. It was after I sold my first book and I was just like, I just want to go away, like, and try to write something new. So I made up the pitch right there. Like, I just made up the pitch. And it's basically the same as what the book came to be. So I made up the pitch and I sent it out. And actually, part of the issue was that when I sold All of Us with Wings, I sold it originally as an adult book. And then the press came back and said, we'd like to put it out as a young adult. So I was working on an adult project that could not be switched. It couldn't be, there was no way. So I was sort of left thinking I needed to work on something new. I needed something that was going to be a YA because I had decided that was going to be the best thing to do next. But I had nothing, and I had kind of disconnected from that project that I thought I was going to be working on. So yeah, I just made something up. But then I thought, what if I did write this book? And then I started to sort of dive in and did research around the things that I said, which was really the mashup of the fairy tale and the myth, and got way more into the fairy tale as well. It's kind of, the fairy tale is kind of a Hansel and Gretel story. There's like this mean stepmother who is like really abusive to the kids and sends them out into the forest, and which unbeknownst to them, she has poisoned all of the water sources in the forest. So each book section has a quote from the fairy tale. Whoever drinks from me will become a tiger at the very beginning of Act One. So what happens is the brother gets really thirsty, and the sister, every time they approach a water source, hears this little voice that says, whoever drinks from me will become a tiger. And then in the next one, whoever drinks from me will become a wolf. And then whoever drinks from me will become a roe, a roebuck, a deer. So it's, I thought, how interesting that sister's intuition is guiding her through, but the brother's thirst is what guides him. And I thought, that's interesting. You've got character motivations right there. And you've got two kids on their own who've never been on their own before. So yeah, it all just sort of came together and it did really piece together. And then when I got into 90s Portland, I had all of this other material coming in around, Riot Girl and the 90s and what was happening here in Portland. And that all just, yeah, it kind of just started to weave itself. But you're right, it is, for me, it is very tapestry. Like, it's like I'll get one bit and then it leads me down another road and then I'll get another bit. So yeah, I did also a bunch of Artemis research, which really helped me get some of the imagery and details in the book as well. Apparently there used to be Artemis cults, Mia, where
I believe
little
it.
girls would go for rites of passage, and they would first be Artemis's little bees, and then at their rite of passage, which I think had to do with their first menstruation, they would become Artemis's bears. And I thought that bee to bear transition and like wearing of bear skins and embodying that bear energy was a really fascinating thing, for young women. So that really headed me, kind of straight in a certain way, straight for Riot Girl. It's like that's very radical. And originally I thought maybe there'd be this sort of cult in Portland of these Artemis worshippers, but that didn't work out, but the imagery remains. So maybe that's another book. I don't know.
That absolutely sounds like another book, maybe like a companion novel set in the similar world. Well, you touched a little bit about my next question, which is, I always love that you crowdsource a little bit of your details. I always remember your Facebook posts that are like, "Okay, 90s babies, do you remember?" Even though they make me feel like I'm the uncoolest person ever because I never remember, I'm always like, "No, I was a Nickelodeon person in the 90s." That's all I got. I'm so sorry. So can we can so that leads to the why 90s era Portland, if you can expand a little bit on that, because it's such a wonderful like setting. Absolutely, it was like so just like came to life.
Well, okay, so I moved to Portland in the 90s, and I think, Mia, that you might have been, born in the 90s because you were probably still kind of a kid, I'm guessing. I think I'm a little older than you. That's all I'm going to say. So give yourself a break. You didn't, you were doing what you were supposed to be doing at that time. As for me, I was particularly boring at that time as well, because I, when I first moved to Portland, I was in my 20s and I came here pregnant with my daughter. And so I was not like really going out and partying. I was like trying to figure out like how to open the stroller and put the car seat, you know, all of those accoutrements were very difficult for me. So anyway, I was busy. My husband was busy. We were just trying to like be grownups all of a sudden. It was a bit of a surprise turn of events for us. So we were like, okay, now what? But all the friends that I met at that time, you know, most of them didn't have kids and were out kind of in this really amazing scene in Portland. So I started to research. The reason that I said it in that time was, in a way, this book is a companion to All of Us with Wings, in that I'm looking at the things that were happening, you know, kind of in the late 80s and early 90s that have become just normal now, that have been just, they're just like an accepted part of even mainstream reality, like even little things like tattoos and piercings, like no one had those. That was super alternative. Now, like, you know, your grandma's got one and it's cool, you know, I'll be one of those grandmas myself. But so I was curious about that. And I was also curious about pre-gentrification in certain cities, because the tech boom brought certain kinds of gentrification to West Coast places that that I, you know, watched unfold, that is just kind of phenomenal, the change, the amount of change in that part of my lifetime. So I was curious about that, like people, you know, like when technologies come kind of bang in the middle of your lifespan, like how the change, you know, manifest. And so Portland really is so different than when I first moved here. And so I wanted to think about too, like, and also people are really like easily very frustrated with the city right now. We are a very white city. We have a lot of work to do around racial justice. And we have this history that for many years wasn't talked about, although now it's beginning to be too. So I wanted to also reckon with all of the things that make me frustrated with Portland, but also to remember that I did fall in love with this place, and we moved here for a reason, and we raised our family here for a reason. So, you know, a lot of what was happening then was a lot of that DIY movement that became so trendy really was out of, you know, just really poor artists that were here because they could afford to live here. A lot of the alternative parenting culture that we take for granted now came out of places like Portland, where artists, you know, decided, like punk rockers decided, like, we're having kids and we need to live somewhere we can afford. And so all of the sort of alternative stuff came out of that. You know, they came to places like this, congregated and made community. So there's a lot of alternative education here. And also there was a lot of DIY feminist activism here that came out of Riot Girl, which, you know, was a musical and political movement in the early 90s, where girls sort of tried to reclaim the music space for themselves and bring feminism, you know, into sort of punk music. And it was, you know, pretty amazing. So all of that and more.
I think you did a wonderful job with it. It made me want to learn more because I obviously did not know that much about it. So let's talk a little bit about the role of theater in this book. There's a bit at the end that I won't spoil, but there is an element of theater and play and interpretation throughout the whole book. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that.
Yes. Well, I am a theater nerd. Like I could speak too much about it, but I will try to contain. I came to theater, you know, as an elementary school kid, and I was really lucky to go to a school that had a bunch of theater nerds on the staff. And so they made a theater program because that's what they wanted to do. That was how they could, you know, have fun while they were, you know, at work. We had these elaborate musicals that we put on in plays. And then that really funneled into a very dedicated drama teacher that taught in both the middle and high schools. And so I was sort of with her, Donna Russell. I will shout her out every time I can, because I really, I became interested in, you know, why did humans make theater? You know, she taught us like theater history, and she taught us, you know, from the Greek drama up. And I became fascinated with story structure and why a play is a play. And I think that, you know, I don't know if anyone else was nerding out in the same way as I was, but my little wheels were really turning in. So I was in plays in high school. I did leave high school early. I was having a lot going on in my family, but the theater bug really stayed with me. And I studied acting in San Francisco after I left home and just tried to find it and keep it in my life for years. I had a little theater space here in Portland when my kids were little. So theater has been a big part for me. And I thought, really, it's affected the whole way I think. And I was having a really hard time with if. I knew Orr right away. I just knew Orr. But if I didn't, I couldn't find her until I realized if is a theater nerd, and everything she's seeing in her world, she's looking at through that lens. And not only that, she is someone who, like my kids, grew up with artists for parents. So everything that they sort of think about and talk about has got this double lens of, their dad's looking at, architecture and how that interacts with society, and their mom is looking at sort of dance and theater and how that, affects everything around her and the way that she does her artistic process. So I thought, if's coming of age story is very specifically in some ways the coming of age story of an artist. There's a German word and it's like Blumungsroman, but I can't say it, but it's like, it means literally, I love these compound German words, coming of age as an artist. And so I thought about that, and that is what helped me figure her out and get in there. And then, also like in terms of, my relationship to, magic, and I write magic realism, but I also feel like that really reflects my personal worldview. I think that ritual and magic and theater are all kind of combined. So that really helped me to find a way for if to deal with a situation that was sort of unthinkable and unfixable using regular logic. And she had to sort of embrace fairy tale logic, story logic, theater logic in order to approach this problem. And in a way, she was oddly well-equipped to deal with it when something that I won't spoil happens in the book that is really just out of anyone's experience of what to do.
That's so interesting, because in my head, as you were talking, I had this question of, did at any moment the characters in this book of if and or, did you find that, I feel like as a writer, my characters do this all the time when they're fighting against, in my head, is their storyline, or is the, like, for example, you have the Greek play and also you have the fairy tale. And I'm wondering if either of them fought against, I guess, their destiny, is what I'm trying to say, at any point, or they became difficult characters.
Definitely they do. Both of them, I think. If especially kept doing things that would surprise me every turn. Like, I thought she was one way because she's very insecure, and she's also very sort of angry because she's a teenager who is incredibly talented and bright, but who's been kind of sidelined because she doesn't fit, her theater department at her school's idea of what a leading lady should be like. Her body type isn't that, she's brown, she's not, she's not what her drama teacher thinks should be the lead in the play. And I was thinking about this, what that would have been like, because even though this was the 80s, this was like the mid 80s when I was in high school, and my teacher was doing, casting kids of color in roles that were typically like white roles, in Oscar Wilde or whatever, like I was getting leads in the play where I don't know if I would have, if I hadn't been with that particular teacher. And I was thinking about what a big deal that was, actually, because that wasn't happening back then very much. And I think that, so I thought, what would that sideline kind of person be like? And so she had a lot of things in her that I was just surprised by. She was mad, but she was also oddly detached in a certain way because her theater brain would always kick in. So there were times when, for instance, there's a bit of a love triangle in the book, and I would keep thinking like, she's just going to like flip out or be jealous or do something out of her insecurity. But then like her theater brain would kick in and she would do something else. That was always surprising to me. I wasn't sure, but then I was thinking about it too. And the big sister in the fairy tale and Iphigenia both have instances where they do the surprising thing, not out of emotion, but out of sort of this intuitive wisdom that is also kind of part intuition, part common sense. So it's kind of funny because they would surprise me. They wouldn't be doing what I thought they were going to do, but then in a way they were true to their source tales in a way that I hadn't noticed. So I think that's just our subconsciouses as work at work as writers, you know? It's like we know more and we've noticed more about the story than we know we have. And so then it comes in and it takes us by surprise. But those are the best surprises.
Those are the best surprises. And I feel like that shows the care and the love that you have for those source materials as well. So the book's coming out July 6th. What is up? What is your launch event? What do you have planned to celebrate? Where can we find you and support you and watch you virtually talk all about this book?
Well, the launch event, I'm so happy, is it is going to be virtual and it's going to be through Powell's, which is really great because Powell's really features in the book. So Powell's Books, if you don't know Portland, like it really is like it's a city, a whole city block of books. It is like sort of book nirvana. And for kids who've been raised in Portland, like my kids, it's like, you know, it's just like it's your childhood. Your childhood is Powell's. Like, you know, you start in the kids' room and you move up, and it's this whole sort of evolution of self. You know, through bookstore. So I was so happy when Pals said that they would host our event. I'm going to be speaking with beloved Portland author Lainey Taylor, who has been an amazing supporter of my book. We've both lived here for years and we've never met. So we finally, you know, met and had a sort of masked porch meeting where I brought her an ARC of the book, which she so sweetly asked for, and then decided that we'd do the Pals event together. And she's lovely, so I'm really excited to talk with her, especially because I admire her work so much. You know, talk about the queen of lyrical sentences. Totally. So we're gonna have a nice time. We're gonna talk. And actually, she is really good at knowing where the best bakeries are in Portland. And I was like stalking her Instagram, and there's this amazing bakery that uses all sort of garden-grown botanical ingredients and like edible decorative flowers. And these cakes just look like things that the fairies would eat. So I'm getting one of those cakes for my book launch.
Yes.
And then you know, so we'll just eat that at home. And then I'm thinking I might have a little outdoor park get together afterward, maybe just like to have donuts and champagne or something. And just, you know, invite a few people to hang out. I mean, it's very different than my first book launch because we had a huge party, and but we're, you know, we're not quite there yet, but we're getting there. We're moving toward normal. So that's going to be great. So that will be on the night of the book launch at 5 p.m. PST. You can go to pals.com and sign up. And I would really love to see people there. That's going to be the big celebration. I'm also going to have another event with Tattered Cover, but we haven't settled the date for that. I think that'll be later in the month. And I'm going to be talking with Samantha Mabry, who's also one of my huge favorites. If you've not read her book, Tigers, Not Daughters, gosh. Okay. I'm the only person in the universe that still has a landline, and it never rings, but it just rang. So
That means something in the theater, Greek fairy tale world. I
I
feel like
know,
that
yeah,
means
but
something.
yeah, so the muse is calling, I don't know. But so there's that. And then I'm also going to be doing an event with Booksmith in San Francisco again. You know, to be announced. But definitely come and join me at Pals. And yeah, we're still really working out the details in this sort of post-pandemic-ish world. There may be an in-person event later in the summer here in Portland. And there may also be one in Seattle. We're still working on it. So yeah, just follow me on Instagram at Michelle Ruiz Kyle. I'm mostly on Instagram. I'm sometimes on Twitter these days at Michelle R. Kyle. And I'm actively on my author Facebook, you know, Michelle Ruiz Kyle. So you can find me all those places and my website, which honestly is not updated, but I'm going to do that this weekend, I promise. So you will be able to figure out where I am, and hopefully there will be a few more places once we get it all figured out.
You knew I was going to tell you to update your website from the way
Yeah.
you looked at me.
That's my
Is there, what are you, if you can share, if you're working on anything currently that you're allowed to talk about? I know that that's sensitive for certain artists that don't like to talk about what they're working on, but we'd love to hear what you're working on next.
Well, I'm working on a book for adult science. Actually, that book I mentioned that was like put aside that I was gonna work on, I am working on. It's for adults, and it's really leaning even harder into the fairy tale world. And it's a novel and stories that I'm thinking of now as, I don't know if you're familiar, but there's a book called A Visit from the Goon Squad, which was a Pulitzer Prize winner. That was a novel and stories that got me real excited about that form. And then so it's sort of that meets Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber, which is a very famous dark fairy tale retelling, definitely for adults. But
love
so
it.
I'm kind of trying to look at it as a mashup of that and working through these fairy tales. And it, in a way, even though it's an adult book, it's, I think, a little bit of kind of a companion in thought, at least, to my first two books. And then I think after that, I have sort of lined up in the queue. I want to write about my Mexican family that came from Redlands, California to the Bay Area, you know, in the late 20s, and settled in this company town that was a sugar refinery plant town, and what her life was like there. My great aunt, Auntie Pauline, has been doing all this genealogy research and has really just, she holds the stories for the family. So this summer I'm going to go and try to collect those from her and think about writing about my family. Oh my God. Yeah, no.
That's the fates. That's the fates calling, telling you to do that immediately.
I kind of feel like it's like, Nana, are you telling me you want me to do this? I think the answer to that is yes.
And is the audiobook coming out at the same time as the hardcover? Because I know that you read the audiobook. So will that be available?
Yes. Yes, it will be read. It will be out the same time as the hardcover. And I really, the audiobook thing is a dream come true. Like, I really, 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 really wanted to do that. And I had to be, hopefully I wasn't too pesky about my desire for this. You know, I feel like you should be really like easy to work with and all of that. But maybe if you could pick one thing that you really want, you could be slightly pesky about it. And I think that was, I may have used up, who knows how many points I used up in the, you know, irritating author bank. But anyway, I really wanted to do it. And I was so happy when Recorded Book said yes. And yeah, I worked with a great studio here in Portland, and they were just lovely. So it was really fun. Oh, and it will be out the day my book is out, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, wonderful. That's awesome. Thank you so much for joining us for the third episode of Radio Musas. This has been wonderful. Is there anything else that you wanted to shout out before we headed out?
No, just sending love to Las Musas because they're the best. And to Mia, for you, for doing this. It was so fun. I always just like to talk to you. So, you know, I would do that on a podcast or off one. So it was just really great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. It was wonderful. This was great. I'm so excited to see the finished product once we add all of the atmospheric sounds. All right. So if you'd like to learn more about Las Musas or our books, please visit our website at lasmusasbooks.com or find us on social media at Las Musas Books. And be sure to check out our bookshop page, where each purchase of one of our books goes towards supporting independent bookstores. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also sign up for Las Musas newsletter to have podcast updates, as well as other Musa news, such as release dates, teasers, spotlights, and more delivered straight to your inbox. Thanks for listening.